Hi there. I'd like to welcome all of you to our Fund Finance panel, co-hosted with Fund Finance Partners. Thank you all for joining. I am Julia Boyd, a private equity M&A partner in Reed Smith's New York office, and am joined by my partners Liz Tabus, who specializes in finance, and Parik Dasgupta, who specializes in funds. I'm very pleased to welcome Dave Phillip of Crestline Investors, Tom Glover of Investec, Taylor Johnson of Naveen, and our co-host Richard Wheelahan of Fund Finance Partners. We'll take a few moments for each of the panelists to briefly introduce themselves and tell a little bit about their background in the industry. Dave?
Sure. So this is Dave Phillip. I'm a senior portfolio manager for Crestline Investors in our portfolio financing fund. In our fund, we are essentially a non-bank lender providing bridge finance to private equity and private capital pools. Crestline is a 25-year-old investment firm with a little bit more than $10 billion of assets, focused primarily across the credit strategy spectrum with a focus around opportunistic strategies. I was on Wall Street for just a little bit more than a decade, and then following that, a decade in private investing firms. And I joined Crestline in 2013, really to establish what is now known as the Fund Liquidity Solutions Group, again, which focuses on solutions for private equity funds and private asset strategies.
Thank you, Dave. Tom?
Hi. Yes, Tom Glover here from Investec. I co-head our global focus on the NAV product as well as strategic GP capital. I joined Investec 18 months ago, having been an investment banker working with private equity sponsors and being actively involved in LevFin and M&A for 30 years. And I am working with Investec to build both the NAV and the GP business here in the U.S. alongside of my partners in London. We are funded through Investec, the bank, as well as institutional capital relationships. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Taylor?
Taylor Johnson from Naveen Real Estate. I cover capital markets across all of our domestic equity products. Naveen Real Estate, many of you may know it as an affiliate of TIAA. But we have about $130 billion of assets under management in the commercial real estate space.
Great. Thank you. Richard?
Thanks, Julia. Richard Wheelahan. I'm a co-founder of the advisory firm Fund Finance Partners. The partners at FFP have arranged over 600 unique credit facilities for asset managers, their managed accounts, funds, both public and private. And we represent about 25 collective years in either the principal capacity in asset management and capital markets or an advisory capacity, whether it's legal or otherwise. We provided these advisory services and arrangement services to not just the funds and not just the asset managers, but also across asset classes and strategies, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S.
Thank you, Richard. Liz?
Hi, I'm Liz Tabus. I am a leveraged finance partner at Reed Smith. I focus on complex credit and spend a lot of time on complex fund financing and NAV facilities at the moment with a probably deep expertise in cross-border financings for funds. And I work with Parik and Julia a lot on the facilities. Parik, do you want to?
Hi, this is Parik. I'm a partner at Reed Smith, and I focus on fund formation. We represent fund managers and fund sponsors of across different strategies and different sizes and geographical focus. We've been actively involved in various fund finance facilities and post-COVID world liquidity solutions for various funds, and again team up with Liz and Julia frequently on advising clients on those matters.
Great, thank you. And thank you all for joining. Before we dive in, I'd like to note that there will be opportunity for the audience to ask directed questions, and we'd also like to note that the call is being recorded. Richard, why don't we start with you? What is fund finance and why is it getting so much attention right now? Do you feel that interest is sustainable? And can you give us any insight into the market and who is lending right now?
Yeah, thanks, Julia. And thanks to all the attendees who made the time to dial in. We appreciate it and hope you find it helpful. The good news is that I can see an attendee list, and I know that everyone who's dialed in probably knows what fund finance is. That being said, we are, for the purpose of this conversation, using the word fund finance, the term fund finance, to describe the leverage strategies and tactics that any alternative asset manager uses to manage liquidity, working capital, or enhance returns in funds, SMAs, and management companies. FFP and fund finance are intimately familiar with or include subscription lines, umbrellas, NAV facilities, hybrids, ManCo lines, conduits, other temporary forms of esoteric financings, and among other things. It's evolved from a product to a real industry in the last decade, and crisis begets opportunity. And with Reed Smith, FFP believes that the disruption that's occurring right now, simultaneous with the industry's high watermark for innovation over the last couple of years, makes this an incredibly opportune time to have an honest discussion about where fund finance is and where it's headed. The good part of this call is we've got a lot of people who are steering where it's headed. And among all of the attendees that have dialed in, there are plenty of leaders in the industry as well. And so FFP and Reed Smith collectively are looking forward to the next iteration of this industry for the better. In fund finance and in any of our functions, as whether you're an attendee or a panelist, I think the top of the totem pole typically is the fund sponsor, who has the demand for the facility, who has the ability to mandate its lender and its advisor and its counsel and everything else. Taylor, to put you on the spot as the one who's on the top of the totem pole, as a GP and as a fund sponsor, Nuveen is a huge asset management firm, and it's involved in just about every strategy. Tell us about the strategy that you're attached to in a little bit more detail and how you and your role and how Nuveen as a firm approaches the fund finance market.
Yeah, sure. So I cover quite a few strategies. So across our domestic equity mandates, there's about 18 different mandates, and this can be anything from a separate account, an open-end fund, closed-end fund, joint venture, or even, as far as a non-traded REIT. And this generally covers all asset types. So this is multifamily, office, retail, industrial, and other alternatives as well. But in aggregate, it's about $53 billion of gross asset values, and there's about $13 billion outstanding of debt. But we typically look at this, on an asset, or sorry, mandate-by-mandate basis, and that will kind of dictate what we do in terms of debt strategy. And this is also influenced by our investor base, which can be either domestic or international investors, retail investors, high-net-worth individuals, as well as institutional investors such as sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, or other insurance companies.
Among those funds, Taylor, what types of leverage does Nuveen utilize in the real estate strategy? Are we talking about, I would say plain vanilla subscription lines? Is there any aspect of NAV financing, any short-term financing? What does your toolbox look like in your capital markets role for all of those different funds and investor bases and everything else?
Sure. So it generally depends on what the strategy or what type of fund it is and sort of where it is in its life cycle. So I'd say generally speaking for all of our closed-end funds, and even in some cases where we have open-end funds as well, we will usually set up subscription lines. And usually this is initially to kind of get things going. So this is anything from helping with liquidity, improving investment returns. Usually these lines are a bit more creative than your typical project level financing. And they allow us to kind of build the fund to a certain size where, we kind of get better economies of scale where it may make sense to aggregate assets together and then finance those. So usually it's subline, and then that may morph into project level finance or doing something on an unsecured basis. From my perspective, generally speaking, when you're doing more fund leverage, it's generally speaking a bit more flexible. It allows you to kind of take advantage of, other relationships, or you're not so much in the weeds dealing with lenders to lenders. I think now is a great example of a time where, in some cases, we have sort of completely sidestepped a lot of the forbearance conversations, mainly because
we don't have project-level debt on all of our assets. In terms of looking at sort of NAV financing, that is something that's a bit new, and I think we've talked to you guys about that as well. But that mainly came up in the context of looking at one of our core debt funds where we were looking at potentially advancing against not only structured notes but as well as uncommitted capital from investors.
So is it safe to say that given the differences in, I would say, on the capital side with respect to investor liquidity concerns or reallocations, and then on the asset side, strategic advantages or opportunities from dislocation, is it fair to say that as a capital market professional for a large asset manager that your leverage strategies are to some extent under review given the changes?
So I would say generally speaking, yeah, we think through certain things just as in the context of what just recently happened, obviously with the COVID narrative. I'd say generally speaking, we are sort of happy with sort of what we had laid out. And I think to my point earlier, we have avoided some of the pitfalls of project level debt. You know, we're not having to deal with talking to lenders on, you know, whether it's debt forbearance or whether it's lease modifications. A lot of that is sidestepped by, you know, using more fund leveraged finance. So I think for the time being, we're pretty happy with how it sort of turned out.
Well, if there's anything that you can tell the lenders on this call, who, let's face it, they came to hear from you, the sponsor and the mandate provider, what they need to do and what they need to hear from a Tier 1 sponsor, what would that be?
So I'd say, generally speaking, you know, when I talk to a number of different lenders, whether it's banks or insurance companies, there is a lot of talk about everyone is looking at deals, but, you know, actually producing a term sheet is something that's, you know, easier said than done. But I would say right now is a very opportune time where if you are a lender looking to make relationships with certain borrowers, just because of the sort of lack of activity in the market right now, this is a great time to sort of make some of those relationships. And I'd say generally speaking, you know, people looking at obtaining liquidity now will have a pretty favorable sort of outlook on lenders that were there for them in this current circumstance. But I would say, you know, the big message just to continue to be active and maybe to the extent possible, there has been a huge focus on, you know, internal credit. And I think now, today, more than ever, a lot of the credit committees have a bit more sort of power and influence on, you know, really stifling new business. To the extent that that can be sort of battered back a little bit and sort of a bit more leeway on that, I think now is a great time to take advantage and sort of make new opportunities.
Thanks, Taylor.
Sure.
Does anyone on the line have any questions? Tina, would you be able to provide some instructions for questions?
My pleasure. Via the phone lines, you may press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone keypad to register a question or comment. Once again, via the phone lines, you may press 1-4. One moment, please. We currently show no phone questions.
Okay, great. Tarek, are there any changes to fund documents that you are seeing to address fund leverage in light of COVID and broader line usage?
Yeah, so we are seeing a number of trends generally. I mean, under current market dynamics, have resulted in an increase in LP transfers, restructuring via secondaries, more top-up and expense, but also definitely increase in the use of subscription facilities. So, I mean, the background is important here in the sense whenever there has been a financial liquidity crunch or so on or cash flow management issues, even back in 2008, 2009, you know, most of these situations were managed. And, you know, the industry is not accustomed to LP defaults, so they always manage. And so subscription lines have become very important. And I think what we are seeing in documentations is you know, there was a general gradual pushback against the length of subscription facilities that we saw in the last couple of years. I mean, you know, with ILPA and everything pushing back on length of subscription facilities. I think we are now seeing a situation like COVID-19 lockdowns increasingly are making managers very sensitive to that, and we are again seeing a resistance to reducing that time. So I think, you know, that will be we'll see how it develops, but we are definitely seeing longer maturity dates for subscription facilities in the market, in the new documents.
Okay. Richard, when would you propose a NAV solution for a potential borrower and direct them to lenders like Dave at Crestline and Tom and Investec?
Sure. And you got to remember, I'm a biased. I'm a former credit fund manager, so I love leverage. In fact, I love leverage on top of leverage. But, you know, we start that conversation with clients when we look at their fund model and their investment strategy from the bottom up. And if the collateral as a whole has a sufficient cash flow to post solid forecasted fixed charge coverage ratios, interest coverage ratios, any amortization requirement, as long as NAV leverage is permitted in the fund docs, we recommend going to market and getting bids. We would, and we have, recommended NAV proposals by both Dave and Tom to our sponsor clients, depending on the situation. If you're gearing a performing credit portfolio for yield enhancement, pricing's typically narrower and advance rates higher in the traditional bank lender realm. But let's be honest, how many of those do we have right now? Not many. For PE and private equity real estate, the facilities are increasingly making sense for many reasons. And in fact, that's most of the volume of where we are steering those opportunities to NAV lenders, just like Tom and Dave. You know, you can't or you shouldn't sell tactically or strategically into a down market. The pricing superior in these NAV facilities to the detrimental effect of selling the collateral at super low valuations just to make margin calls or pay distributions that are required, as well as the significantly greater flexibility that the facilities that those firms are offering compared to a depository institution. In the current situation, they have a little bit more to offer than ever before.
Great. And what are the biggest and smallest NAV deals you're seeing?
The biggest and smallest NAV deals that we are mandated on right now are as small as $15 million at the fund level for a tactical need for a private equity portfolio, and the largest is about $750 million for a credit strategy that is probably a little bit more opportunistic than defensive at this time.
Are you seeing a lot of borrowers in the current market weighing the use of NAV against a preferred structure? And what are some of the factors your clients are considering?
Yeah, we are. And again, this is kind of my explanation, you know, maybe a little bit different than how my partner, Zach, would explain it just based on our complementary experience. But as a former credit investor, it's the same approach that the lenders are considering, right? What is the borrower's debt service capacity? What is that debt service capacity under a stressed scenario? And is the NAV loan truly constructive for, you know, given its debt service requirements? Or is it only delaying a potential liquidity squeeze for another quarter? It also necessarily depends on the underwritten return on a gross basis, as well as the unrealized IRRs that the firm's projecting for the rest of its life cycle and how that impacts their ability to hit hurdles, satisfy investor expectations, and whatnot. Those are all moving factors, but the good news is they are all quantifiable. And so with each client, it's a modeling exercise, right? And the model is only as good as the inputs, and none of us know the future, but it's at least a helpful way to get the borrower comfortable with what path they select.
Thank you, Richard. Parek, do funds typically need to amend their documents to do a NAV deal? Are there any sector-specific fund documentary considerations which might drive a fund to decide to use one structure versus another?
Yeah, sorry, I was speaking on mute there. Definitely. I think it's something. There are multiple structures available. In terms of structuring solutions where you don't want to sell your portfolio in a down market, I would say setting up other top of funds or GP-led secondaries are options available. I mean, depending on your investor base, top of funds essentially act like a discount to discount on fees and carry for getting exposure to existing investments, and in GP-led secondaries, you give the investors the option to cash out. And as we know, in a post-COVID-19 lockdown world, cash is king. So depending on the investor base, those may be viable solutions. Or equally, depending on the fund strategy and the investor base, you may look at NAV-based solutions. And typically, most closed-end funds do not expressly limit the amount of leverage the fund can take, at least below the fund, albeit, there are limitations on the amount of guarantee the fund could give. But we frequently find, in the documents, you'll be surprised how many fund documents have these missing. But one should be careful to include, give the fund the ability to have joint several liabilities with other fund entities, put the limitations on portfolio company debt guarantees and subscription facilities in different buckets, and equally, in your leverage ratio covenants, you probably want to make sure that subscription facility is carved out as against NAV loans. And similarly, I think this, make sure that you have the right grace period in terms of your leverage ratio restrictions. I think that those are the key things that we see that go missing many a times and before you get into a NAV kind of solution.
Thank you, Parik. So we switched to the lender's view. Liz, Dave, Tom, do you want to speak to that?
Sure. So on the first half of the call where we were sort of taking the fund and asset manager view, Taylor had mentioned that fund financing really provides sort of an insurance policy and optionality. And in working with Dave and Tom, it's an experience I can say, they provide some of the most creative and helpful leverage in the market, and it's particularly relevant right now. With that in mind, Tom, do you want to talk about who's using NAV lines now and what is the composition of the funds that are utilizing NAV lines right now? And is that changing? Are there classes that you think are better to support NAV lines generally and better to support NAV lines in this market?
Liz, thanks so much. Historically, NAV lines in the private equity world were typically used by middle and lower middle market private equity firms, and primarily as a source of repair capital. The heavier users in the past of NAV capital, as Richard mentioned, were away from private equity in the areas of private credit and real estate. But what we're seeing right now is that the NAV product in private equity is moving strongly from the early adopter phase to penetrating mainstream, well-known clients. And what's happening is actually very analogous to the evolution of the adoption of another fund finance tool, which is the GP-led continuation fund product. 5 years ago, that was done on a very sporadic basis by small funds. Now it's being used by some of the very biggest funds on the planet. As I mentioned, at the moment, there are a number of highly recognizable mid-cap and middle-market sponsors that aren't just tire-kicking the product, but are actually moving forward on NAV-based deals.
Dave, in your experience, what are the reasons that the funds you're working with are using NAVs, and what are some of the popular structures that you've seen, I guess, both historically and now, and what's changing in light of COVID?
Sure. Happy to go into it. And Tom, it's good to be – I guess you and I are at the bottom of the totem pole if Richard has positioned all of the sponsors at the top of the totem pole. So at least we're in good
No, that's us. I know where we sit.
I would say I would say, first of all, historically, and, you know, Tom and us, we, you know, we view the world quite similarly. So, Tom, if you got any, you know, other things to add as I go through this, feel free to jump in. You know, we look at the world of NAV loan uses basically in three categories. You know, users that want to borrow to enhance their NAV, and these tend to be uses that are along the lines of growth capital, financing acquisitions, buyouts, or buybacks. You know, we see users look at it for NAV preservation, and this is more in the rescue capital realm, either to provide, you know, last mile financing, requisite working capital, or to shore up balance sheet financials to avoid any covenant issues. And then finally, we see NAV lines being used more for portfolio management aspects, and this is either to accelerate distributions or to do bridging or warehouse financing. You know, unlike maybe the way Richard viewed the world from a credit perspective, I actually like to view NAV lines more as a provision of liquidity than necessarily leverage. And lots of our capital is being used to either shore up equity balance sheets or to replace more expensive or detrimental leverage. So not all NAV facilities, you know, are actually adding to an aggregate leverage perspective. In the current environment, you know, if you just think of it from a sponsor's perspective, you know, it's a bit of a perfect storm. You have revenue shortfalls of unknown severity and unknown duration coming up from their portfolio companies. They're trying to figure out what the startup costs might be, what business model adjustments are going to happen when, you know, we get to the new normal or the new normal or whatever it might be. And at the exact same time, you're seeing a pullback in the credit market. So some of their more traditional financing sources, either at the fund or at the portfolio company level, are falling away. We're seeing a pause in the capital markets and M&A activity, so sponsors that were maybe looking to sell one of their assets and recycle that to generate internal liquidity, that's slowing down. It's also expanding the holding period of their underlying assets. We're seeing a pause in the secondary markets, so their LPs that are looking for third-party liquidity are now looking to the funds a little bit more, and I'll get into that. And on top of everything else, we're seeing a slowdown in fundraising. So more of the bridge and warehouse financing are coming into lines for deals that have been lined up that were, you know, hoping to purchase it through equity capital. So I'd say what, you know, what we've seen over the last, call it 2 to 3 months, has been the following. The first was a massive wave of inquiry. Lots of sponsors, some who knew about the product, some who didn't, were calling in on an exploratory basis, trying to figure out the basics. How do they work? What are the terms? What does my portfolio composition need to look like, et cetera? Many of whom were really just trying to figure out what are the potential sources of capital. Over the last month, I think some of those, you know, those that rush to for information has toned down a little bit. Most sponsors now have a better sense of what their capital, at least the capital requirements, are going to be to deal with their protective needs. So now that attention is turned to, okay, I know what capital gap I'm trying to solve for. Where do I get it from? And so now it's, how much of it do I think I can get from government stimulus programs? Can I get money from the CARES Act? If I got money, should I keep it? Should I give it back? How much other capital can I raise at the portfolio company level, either through drawing down revolvers, new equity? And then the secondary gap is sort of being filled by the sponsor. And if it's a sponsor that's beyond an investment period or has expired all of its commitments, you know, it needs now to think about, all right, do I run my business as a non-all-equity balance sheet, and do I think about NAV loans as a potential solution? And that's, I think, where we are in terms of our inquiries. The second piece, I'd say, going back 3 to 4 weeks ago, a lot of the inquiries shifted from defensive needs and on the protective side to more opportunistic sourcing, and they fall primarily into one of three categories. One has been equity financing. So sponsor has a portfolio company, likely was already engaged in some level of diligence and negotiation around a deal. When the credit markets pulled back, there was a gap in financing and the deal fell apart. Well, maybe the seller has gotten a little bit more aggressive in terms of trying to consummate the transaction, and it's become a very interesting acquisition at this point, but it needs to be equity financed. So the sponsor would borrow capital from, you know, from us or a NAV provider, and then they would take that at the fund level and distribute it down to a portfolio company as equity. Portfolio company would make its all equity acquisition, And the bridge and the takeout to our loan would ultimately be either when that aggregate portfolio company is sold, if the capital markets come back soon, or refinanced out at the portfolio company if the credit markets come back. We have also seen a slew of opportunistic buyouts of portfolio company co-investors that are seeking liquidity. So a sponsor who, you know, if you've got a portfolio company, you're the majority shareholder, you've got a couple tagged along, you know, minorities in there, and generally everyone is seeking liquidity, as the sponsor, you may be able to offer to help that portfolio company consummate a discounted buyback of those co-investment shares. Again, you'd use our loan to transfer that into equity to buy out those co-investors at the right price. And then, finally, what we've seen is really where the LPs themselves are looking for liquidity historically in the secondary market because of everything that's going on there in terms of pausing. You may have LPs that want to sell out. The most natural buyer of that may actually be the fund as opposed to a third-party new LP, at least in this dynamic where the manager's got the most information, maybe the only bid. And so the fund could essentially borrow capital from a lender, use that capital to buy out an LP at a discount, essentially like a treasury stock trade. Structurally, what we're seeing are, we basically run three primary tools. One is a loan to a fund, a loan to a portfolio company with a simultaneous fund-level guarantee, and a preferred equity structure. In this market, we are definitely seeing preference for fund-level loans. A fund-level loan relative to a loan to a portfolio company with a guarantee oftentimes provides just a lot more flexibility. If you borrow money at the fund level, you can use it simultaneously for protective and opportunistic purposes across different underlying entities. And it just, it gives a lot more flexibility, and you don't necessarily need to know all of your use of proceeds at the front end. And because right now it seems, at least from what I'm seeing, most of the sponsors are trying to solve for a 1 to 3 year funding gap, the NAV loans that generally have shorter repayment components to them, lower MOIC hurdles, and a lot less potential equity upside than the preferred equity structures just seem to be a better cost of capital for some of our borrowers. So maybe with that, I'll pause and hand it back to you, Liz.
Thanks, Dave. That was really helpful. Tom,
this is the operator. I'm terribly sorry to interrupt. We do have a phone question if you'd like to take it.
Sure.
I apologize for the interruption. The question comes from Rob Collarina.
Yes, thank you. This is Rob. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes,
okay,
yep.
Great. My question is with respect to acquisitions and roll-ups. In this post-COVID environment, there are some that are strong that are actually looking to roll up some of the opportunistic situation. Can some of the panelists comment a little bit about what makes them comfortable that whether it's an equity sponsor or a strategic, how they get comfortable on some of the pro forma projections of integration and therefore debt repayment?
Sure. Well, I'm happy to go, and then Tom jump in, and again, Taylor, if you've got, you want to talk to
sure.
us. But from our perspective, since we are really writing a loan against the collection of a fund's assets as collateral, we don't necessarily need to have the same level of roll-through scrutiny at an underlying portfolio company. And generally speaking, our capital is being downstream to equity, so we can provide more flexibility at the acquisition level necessary than, looking at specific debt repayments over time. So for us, it's all about can we get comfortable with the collection of all of the fund's holdings in aggregate, and oftentimes there are easier-to-value components of collateral relative to, a newly acquired acquisition. So, that's the way we generally look at it.
This is Richard again. Dave's right. I would say that if you were looking to do the same thing at the portfolio company level on the platform for the roll-up, you are looking at giving up very high pricing on the facility at the company level, and you're also probably going to have to be you're going to have to give up some kind of upside, whether it's a warrant or some kind of equity co-invest at a not-so-attractive value for you. So being able to borrow the fund level and push it down to the equity is a pretty compelling alternative.
Thank you.
Liz, this is Tom. I'd like to just add, you know, Dave did a great job of surveying kind of the broader world we're living in right now and the uses and so forth. I'd add to that that we're seeing a lot of interest in debt buybacks, both with middle market funds whose portfolio companies don't have tradable debt, but where there may be a portfolio company that's underperforming and you have a lender who might be facing liquidity issues elsewhere in the firm, who would be quite eager to take to be cashed out at a discount. So we're seeing that in the lower middle market and the middle market, and then in the upper middle market into mid cap, where you have term loan Bs, in some cases high yield bonds. We're seeing the same kind of activity, and for sponsors, this can be one of the most accretive ways they can deploy capital right now, because they're basically investing in companies, their own companies that they know extremely well, and they're buying into a loan or a security that will deliver, they hope, a very highly quantifiable return over a target period of time as the asset runs to par and pays its coupons. Back to you, Liz.
Thanks, Tom. I was going to ask you, in terms of where you see the market going next in the next few months, as I think a lot of people are expecting that Q2 at the end of this quarter and Q3, there may be even more changes in the market. Is there anything else that you would think might be sort of next and coming that the listeners on the phone might want to know about?
Sure. Well, I'll pick up on where Dave's timeline. Early on, people were just trying to find out what their options were as they were figuring out what was happening within their portfolios and what their needs were going to be. Right now, we have a number of clients that are now very focused on NAV, whether debt or preferred variants, as the most cost-effective way to address their needs, which typically are a mix of both repair capital and growth capital. I think what you're going to see in the next quarter or so, and we're seeing some of this already right now we're seeing a surge in interest in flexible NAV-based capital to execute on some of the attractive M&A opportunities for existing portfolio companies that Dave referenced. Frankly, a lot of structural pressure to try to find solutions that don't require the NAV facility to be as fully drawn as, you know, we as an industry have expected in the past. You know, people are looking more for lines of credit, so to speak, to finance their acquisition activities. In many cases, just simply, you know, continuing to execute on M&A plans and add-on pipelines that already existed. But I think a couple more things I'd like to point out as we roll forward in time. A lot of GPs have ensured that their portfolio companies have liquidity for now. And many of these companies are actually healthy or should be restored to health when they're allowed to resume business, as lockdown eases. But there are a number of companies that are going to be struggling for the foreseeable future, and I think there's going to be a second wave of demand for NAV as GPs get well into the summer and look forward to the end of the year and realize that some of these companies are going to need additional support beyond what the existing bank group can provide. So I think we'll see that. And then looking further ahead, to the extent, and knock on wood, the economy shows signs of stabilization, an important theme I think you'll begin to see in the fourth quarter and looking into next year is the desire to get capital back to LPs. It's likely the M&A market is not going to be strong enough for many portfolio companies to execute on the exit plans that they had previously envisioned in that time frame, and so they're going to wait. And GPs are going to be highly focused on how to get capital back to their LPs in advance of future exit plans.
Thanks, Tom.
Liz, back to you.
I guess this question is really both for you and Dave. In terms of typical terms and sizing, how do you think the facilities have changed in the last few months, and what differences are noteworthy for the listeners to focus on in terms of covenants or sizing?
Sure. I'll touch on some and turn it over to Dave as well. Generally, what we're seeing is leverage is down and rates are up moderately. We're seeing most of our deals in the high single digits to high teens loan to value, that is NAV facility against NAV. And the that's down 5 to 10%, 5 to 10 points versus where we had been seeing those kinds of LTVs pre-COVID. On the rate side, you know, it depends on what risk category, where you are on the risk curve, but generally up 50 to 100 basis points in the world we operate in. And then on the size aspect, the low end has stayed pretty much the same, 15 to 20 million. We're seeing some requests for 10. But what's really really become part of the new norm is a cohort of deals in the 100 million north size. And we're seeing PE players looking for 100 to 300 now with some frequency when, as I look at my pipeline right now. But the bread and butter still, for us at least, tends to be in the 20 to 75 million area. Not that we can't do the larger deals. We love them. But that's still where we see the greatest, amount of transactions.
Thanks, Tom. Dave, what about you?
Yeah, I'll echo almost everything that Tom said. I mean, risk is getting repriced in this market, mostly because risk is down and pricing has stayed pretty much the same. We're seeing very similar things in terms of size. You know, most of it's in that $25, $75 million sweet spot with certainly some larger deals. And I think part of it is also just the, you know, as Tom mentioned earlier, the size of the franchises and the fund complexes that are exploring this marketplace. I mean, because most of the borrowers aren't looking to maximize leverage, especially in this environment, they're looking to borrow, you know, as little as they can and have the maximum flexibility to either upsize that or pay it back as everybody gets a little bit more information as the data points continue to come through. You know, I would also echo that people are looking very much for more delayed draw structures. Again, how do they maximize the committed available capital to them without paying it all up front, without drawing it all up front? And partly I think that's, you know, the intelligence on the GP side. Some of that is also, you know, making sure that as they socialize it with their own investors, they can, again, maintain this idea of accretive transactions across the board. So, and most people, to be honest, are, when we talk to them about lowering our LTV thresholds in this environment, we don't get pushback. I mean, everybody understands they also don't want to go into a transaction with minimal headroom, not knowing exactly where Q2 marks are going to come out, and, you know, everybody's still kind of guesstimating, again, on severity and duration.
Thanks, Dave. That leads into, I think, our next topic perfectly. What covenants are typical and what type of current cash flow-induced issues are you getting questions about, especially with regard to the payment of interest and exit uncertainty? And how are you guys offering flexibility and interesting solutions to funds that are worried about those things?
So, I mean, I guess for us, the typical covenants, and because this is still somewhat of a bespoke marketplace, you know, the things that we have in all of our deals are generally LTV-related covenants, diversification-related covenants. Sometimes we will approach it with, you know, specific milestones for delayed draw issues, especially if we're pushing up against what we think are appropriate LTVs in this environment. In terms of the cash component of it, I would say 90% of our loans are all PIK. And the main reason for that is, you know, a borrower that doesn't want to have to manage cash flows, especially if it's a non, you know, cash yielding portfolio, and they don't know exactly what the back end duration is going to be because that's going to be dictated when they can sell an asset. they'd rather not overfund for a cash pool just to pay interest. So we tend to not see a lot of pressure on that side. Certainly, we have seen some flexibility around recycling of capital. Are there any additional debt prohibitions at the underlying portfolio companies, for example, on very specific portfolios we look at? We've had, a number of loan modifications, mostly around maturity, people that wanted going into this shorter duration, shorter maturity loans that, sales processes extended. We looked at the collateral. We were very comfortable with coverage ratios, and, so far we've extended all of our loans, to increase them to match what is the new liquidity profile of the borrower.
Thanks, Dave. Tom, any thoughts from you on creative solutions you're seeing or offering, or insights from historical deals about what you can offer?
Sure. First, on the pick front, we pick as well, and many of our loans are full pick. In other situations where they're larger transactions and there's a need to kind of broaden out the lender base, we're seeing demand on some parties' parts to have a cash pay component, which we do try to generally manufacture through giving the borrower incremental capacity that can be drawn to pay a modest kind of mid-single digit portion of the rate in cash. Dave sort of was heading in this direction as well. I think that on the financial covenant front, because of the risk of extended volatility and a further downdraft, there's a lot of discussion lately around on the new deal front around what happens if there's a default. How are we working together? And increasingly, parties are seeking to try to pre-agree processes through which there'll be a resolution, typically through an agreed get together and a meeting of the minds as to the next steps to be taken and a time frame around pursuing those sorts of options. But what's very different about NAV, primary fund NAV, as we're talking about here, is that while our collateral may be the portfolio of the fund, unlike in a secondary financing or a credit fund portfolio financing, the collateral isn't liquid. And so inherently, we must, be close partners with the GPs in resolving issues like that.
Thanks, Tom. And that is my experience 100% on the deals that I work on as well. On these deals, what else can go wrong? What is there anything specific that has gone wrong that either of you want to talk about or has gone really right in terms of opportunistic usage of NAV?
Sure. I mean, in an ideal world, a NAV facility can provide, a win for the sponsor, a win for the sponsor's LPs, a win for the underlying portfolio companies. Obviously, they're all related. As well as a win for the NAV lender, as we feel we're getting good risk-adjusted returns on our capital. So, when it doesn't become a win for everybody, in my opinion, it's a deal that didn't go particularly well. Where I think things can go wrong outside of, asset degradation and a covenant breach or something, the two things that we tend to look for, one are, is the loan outstanding significantly longer than expected for some reason? And as a lender, as long as we're covered, that solves one of the issues. But at the same time, the underlying LPs, whatever ultimate value is manufactured by the monetization of the assets, more and more of that is coming to the lender and less of that's going to the equity holders. It's certainly a risk that every GP needs to factor into their initial discussion, which is why we think, the kind of the bridge loan solutions that, Tom and us offer, makes a lot of sense. And it's not kind of systemic leverage in the system. It's really, thinking about a bridge loan. The winning solutions are one where somebody can take our capital, pay our cost of capital which on a risk-adjusted basis we think is quite good, but take that and translate it into a multiple for their fund. You know, and one of the recent deals that we've exited from, you know, did just that. They had a variety of very illiquid assets, good hard downside protection, you know, tons of upside, but really they weren't assets that most normal institutions would lend against, certainly on a standalone basis. So we were able to come in and with the use of a fund guarantee structure, you know, we were able to get the pledge of assets that had much different and better liquidity profiles for us. We got money to the, you know, the assets that had all the upside but really couldn't borrow directly, facilitated some strategic involvement by third-party capital over time, didn't force the sponsor to sell one of the liquid assets right then, gave them a chance to run through a more normalized sales process. Ultimately, the loan was only outstanding about 18 months. We got, you know, a great return on our side, and the sponsor ended up with more than a 2x return, you know, for him. And so that's when I think it really becomes a liquidity bridge to value where it makes the most sense from a winning process.
Thanks, Dave. Tom
yeah,
or Taylor or Richard?
Yeah, I'll just tag on a brief
ahead,
comment,
please.
Which is we have generally seen the NAV work out extremely well for our issuer base. They've done, as Davis said, they've taken our capital, which essentially is reasonably priced bridge capital, and they've put it to work in the portfolios, and they've reaped returns that are multiples of money and multiples of against the cost of our financing. I think the other thing that's proven out, I think, Dave, for you and certainly for us as well, is the integrity of the NAV product and why it's a superior product. And what I mean by that is that by lending against a portfolio of equity positions in private equity, even if a few go south, the value that remains in the existing portfolio, and in some cases even increases, even in this kind of an environment, is sufficient to leave us as lenders in a well collateralized position, and you know that reality is what allows us to deliver capital at reasonable cost and on a relatively short term basis to clients so that they can seek these multiple on money opportunities that many of them have very much in front of them. So the product is working. And clients we're seeing looking in the rearview mirror have made very good use of the capital.
Thanks, Tom. Richard or Taylor, do you have anything else to add on sort of what works well or anything along those lines?
On the NAV side, I think you've got more options than ever before. I think that some lenders who have historically been dominant in areas, particularly different strategies, may not be as preeminent and open for new relationships as they previously were, and that's created space for new entrants and new products. So if you're the head of capital markets or the CFO, you may need to open your relationships up a little bit to take advantage of a new entrant who's just trying to gain market share by being creative and solution-oriented. We're seeing a thinning of the distinctions between traditional money center bank lenders and the non-bank lenders that have found a way to offer incremental value to borrowers in order to justify sometimes higher spreads than those money center bank facilities. And, finally, I think there's something that an old client of ours told us one time in running a process, if you are a logistically constrained lender who's considering an opportunity that's either brought to you by an intermediary or a sponsor, sometimes the second best answer you can get is a really quick no with a reason why. We're all constrained from a time standpoint, and it's not as easy as it was, but people have long memories and they appreciate the ones who do the work.
Thanks.
Just to build up very quickly. So, Taylor from Naveen, but one thing that we've been exploring recently at Naveen is just alternative sectors.
So whether that means data centers or that means cell towers, single-family residentials, and, you know, we're trying to raise capital around some of these strategies. And I think, you know, from a NAV perspective, it's certainly a bit more interesting to look at it on an aggregate basis with, you know, uncommitted capital plus some of these kind of non-traditional asset classes, just because lenders aren't typically looking for those opportunities. But it is something that we will consider in the future for some of these kind of outside-the-box type investments that we're looking to do in the near future.
Thanks, Taylor. I don't know if anyone else has anything to add. If not, maybe we could open the line up to the listeners if anyone has questions for any of the panelists.
Via the phone lines, you may press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone keypad to register a question or comment. Once again, via the phone lines, you may press the 1 followed by the 4. One moment, please. And we do have a question in the queue. It'll just be a moment while we gather the information.
Thank you.
And thank you for standing by. So the question comes from Leon Stevenson. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Very interesting and lively discussion. And thanks again for putting this on. I echo the thoughts of the panelists in relation to NAV facilities and the recent growth in that area. What we have seen at Reed Smith is a steady development in that area over the past few years, but it's the first time that I've seen the large sponsors actively engage and look for this type of facility. A lot of our clients and prospective clients are actually looking at it from a defensive point of view. So they're looking to put in place a NAV commitment in order to save potentially any underlying assets that may be decreasing in value. I just wanted to come back to the NAVs and just ask the panelists whether they were seeing those facilities put in place for that defensive reason, and again, at the large cap, at the large cap size.
Hey Leon, this is Dave. What we're seeing is a lot of the very large sponsors coming to us, getting prepared to do that. And, you know, we haven't seen a lot necessarily pull the trigger on establishing a facility that would start incurring committed fees or anything on capacity yet, but everyone is, you know, providing NDAs, we're looking at portfolios and providing straw man structures and terms, et cetera, to kick off and accelerate that discussion. And, you know, one thing I just want to maybe note here is that I think part of the reason you're seeing a lot of the sponsors come forward, you know, this is a comment that Tom had earlier, you know, you go back a couple of years in a NAV facility, the discussion between a GP and an LP was sometimes awkward. You had a GP, you know, talking to his set of LPs, explaining that there was some misestimation in liquidity, either positively or negatively, but that sponsor was somewhat of an outlier, and generally those conversations were going to a relatively uneducated LP base in this regard. They just hadn't been approached with a lot of these. You fast forward to today, and I would argue that almost every sponsor is having some discussion with their LP around liquidity needs, and the sponsors that can talk to their investors and say, here are my portfolio capital needs, and you know, here are all the different things I can do to solve it, including even up to a fund-level facility that I can talk to you about, and you now have the opportunity to weigh that against the capital call. I just think the whole product is becoming a lot more acceptable and is being used much more as an active portfolio management tool. And some of that previously, you know, attached stigma is gone, and that's what's allowing a lot of the blue chip firms to kind of come to the table and explore it and understand what inherent collateral value they have that may be able to be used more effectively.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jael Wood. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for a wonderful panel. I have a rather basic question for such a sophisticated panel, but throughout the years, and especially in the 2008 crisis, and currently as well in the current environment, fund finance overall seems to be weathering rather well compared to all the other industries. What do you attribute this to? Thank you.
So this is Liz. Dave and I were on a special six panel earlier in the fall talking about fund finance. And one of the sort of interesting things is that, and I think it is weathering well, but I also think there is a lot of uncertainty because last crisis, it was really a newer product. It was less funds were using it. It was sort of used in different ways. So I think right now it's holding up. But I think it's hard to take 2008-09 and compare it to now. And so I think that people are using leverage really smartly within the funds, and they have a lot of capital generally. But I also think 2008-09 really isn't a proxy for now because the market is so fundamentally changed. Dave, I don't know if you have anything else to add there.
I mean, my view is it's sustainable because it's essentially a fair product, meaning the risk is generally priced effectively and it works for both parties as long as it's used, you know, for primarily highly protective or highly accretive purposes. And I don't think we've really seen a lot of people coming in and abusing the system and over-leveraging really with the NAV facilities that, you know, Tom and I generally offer. So I just think there's been a lot more success stories than not, which is why it's been sustainable both from a lender and a borrower perspective.
Are there any more questions?
There are no further questions at this time.
Great. Thank you very much to our panelists and to all who joined today, and have a great afternoon, evening.
That does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines. Thank you.